Okay, thank you, Melanie. That was very nice. I want to begin with a question. Whoops. You know, first I shouldn't begin with a question. I should begin by putting my reading glasses on. That would actually help a lot, wouldn't it? Ah, good. Yes, I did want to begin with a question. It's true. When did libraries, archives, and museums begin to think about software history collections? The answer to that question is in the late 1970s. The Charles Babbage Institute, CBI, and the History of Computing Committee of the American Federation of Information Processing Societies, AFIPS, soon to be a sponsor of CBI, were both founded in 1978. The AFIPS committee produced a brochure called Preserving Computer-Related Source Materials, distributed at the National Computer Conference in 1978. It is the earliest statement I have found about preserving software history. And it says, if we are to fully understand the process of computer and computing developments, as well as the end results, it is imperative that the following material be preserved: correspondence, working papers, unpublished reports, obsolete manuals, key program listings used to debug and improve important software, hardware and componentry engineering drawings, financial records, and associated documents and artifacts. Mostly paper records. The recommendations say nothing about data files or executable software, only nodding to the museum value of hardware artifacts for aesthetic and sentimental value. The brochure says that artifacts provide, and I'm quoting, a true picture of the mind of the past in the same way as the furnishings of a preserved or restored house provides a picture of past society. 1 year later, CBI received its first significant donation of books and archival documents from George Glaser, a former president of AFIPS. And into the 1980s, history of computing collections meant documentation, archival records, publications, ephemera, oral histories, and things like that. Software preservation trailed documentation and historical projects by a good two decades. The exception, perhaps, was David Behrman, who left the Smithsonian in 1986 to create a company called Archives and Museum Informatics. He began publishing the Archival Informatics newsletter in 1987, that was later called Archives and Museum Informatics. As one of its earliest projects, AHI drafted policies and procedures for a software archives at the Computer History Museum, CHM, then located in Boston. Now it's in the Bay Area. By the end of 1987, Behrman published the first important study of software archives under the title Collecting Software, A New Challenge for Archives and Museums. By the way, is my volume okay? You hear me fine? Okay, good. In his report, Behrman alternated between frustration and inspiration. Based on a telephone survey of companies and institutions, he wrote that, and I'm quoting, the concept of collecting software for historical research purposes had not occurred to the archivists surveyed, perhaps in part because no one ever asks for such documentation. He learned that nobody he surveyed was planning software archives. Undaunted, he produced a report that carefully considered software collecting as a multi-institutional endeavor, drafting collection policies and selection criteria, use cases, a rough software thesaurus to provide terms for organizing a software collection, and a variety of practices and staffing models. Should some institution accept the challenge, here were some tools for the job. Well, here we are, nearly 30 years later. We can say that software archives and digital repositories finally exist. We've made great progress in the last decade with respect to repository technology and collection development. Looking back to the efforts of the 1980s, one persistent issue raised as early as the AFIPS brochure in 1978 is the relationship between collections of historical software and archival documentation about that software. This is an important issue, and I predict that we will discuss it at this conference. Another topic that goes back to Behrman's report is a statement of use cases for software history. Who is interested in historical software, and what will they do with it? These questions prompt my talk today. Let me start by stating the obvious. Using historical software now, in order to experience it in 2014, and running that software in 2014 to learn what it was like when people operated 30 years ago are two different things. This will still be true in 2050. I'm almost embarrassed to make this point, but it's important to understand its implications. An analogy might help. I'm not just talking about the difference between watching Gone with the Wind at home on DVD versus watching it in a vintage movie house in a 35mm print, with or without a live orchestra. Rather, I mean the difference between my experience in a vintage movie house today, when I can find one, and the historical experience of, say, my grandfather during the 1930s. My experience is what it is, not what his was. So I will focus on the complicated problem of enacting a contemporary experience to reenact a historical experience and what it has to do with software preservation. To do this, I will consider three takes on this problem: the historians, the media archaeologists, and the reenactor. Take one, the historian. Historians enact the past by writing about it. In other words, historians tell stories. This is not news, just look at the word, history. The last few decades of writing about the methods of history, that is, about historiography, have been mightily influenced by Hayden White, author of the much-discussed Meta-History, The Historical Imagination in 19th Century Europe, published in 1973. White's main point about historians is that history is less about subject matter and source material and more about how historians write. He tells us that historians do not simply arrange events culled from sources in correct chronological order. Such arrangements, White calls annals or chronicles. The authors of these texts merely compile lists of events. The work of the historian begins with the ordering of these events in a different way. Hayden writes in the content of the form that in historical writing, quoting, the events must be not only registered within the chronological framework of their original occurrence, but narrated as well. That is to say, revealed as possessing a structure, an order of meaning that they do not possess as a mere sequence. How do historians do this? They create narrative discourses out of sequential chronicles by making choices. These choices involve the form, effect, and message of their stories. White puts choices about form, for example, into categories such as argument, ideology, and emplotment. Without getting into the details of every option, the short version of the result is sense-making through the structure of story elements, use of literary tropes, and emphasis placed on particular ideas. In a word, plots. White thus gives the enactment of history as a form of narrative that applies established literary forms such as comedy, satire, and epic. In his book, Figural Realism, Studies in the Mimesis Effect, White writes about the events, persons, structures, and processes of the past that, quoting, it is not their pastness that makes them historical. They become historical only in the extent to which they are represented as subjects of a specifically historical kind of writing. It is easy to take away from these ideas that history is a kind of literature. Indeed, this is the most controversial interpretation of White's historiography. I think I was supposed to go up one there. Sorry about that. My purpose in bringing Hayden White to your attention is to insist that there's a place in game and software studies for this historical kind of writing. I mean writing that offers a narrative interpretation of something that happened in the past. Now, if you have heard me, probably not very many of you have, but if you have heard me using the following quotation before, I apologize, but that won't stop me from using it here again. It's a paraphrase of the line written by the late John Hughes and spoken by Steve Martin to John Candy in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It goes like this. You know, when you're telling these little stories, here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the reader. Game history and software history need more historical writing that has a point. This very conference will produce ideas about what those points might be and where our historical narratives will take us. Allow me one last point about Hayden White as a take on enactment. Clearly, history produces narratives that are human-made and human-readable. They involve assembling story elements and choosing forms. How then do such stories relate to actual historical events, people, and artifacts? Well, despite White's fondness for literary tropes and plots, he insists that historical narrative is not about imaginary events. If historical methods are applied properly, the resulting narrative, according to White, is a simulacrum. He writes in his essay on the question of narrative in contemporary historical theory that history is, quoting him, a mimesis of the story lived in some region of historical reality, and insofar as it is an accurate imitation, it is to be considered a truthful account thereof. Let's keep this idea of historical mimesis in mind as we move on to takes 2 and 3. Take 2 is the media archaeologist. It's inspired by the German media archaeologist Wolfgang Ernst. As with Hayden White, my remarks will fall far short of a critical perspective on Ernst's work. I'm looking for what he says to me about historical software collections and the enactment of media history. Hayden White put our attention on narrative. Enacting the past is storytelling. Ernst explicitly opposes media archaeology to historical narrative. He agrees in Digital Memory in the Archive that narrative is the medium of history. By contrast, quote, the technological reproduction of the past works without any human presence because evidence and authenticity are suddenly provided by the technological apparatus, no longer requiring a human witness and thus eliminating the irony, meaning the insight into the relativity of the subjective perspective. Irony, it should be noted, is one of White's favorite tropes for historical narrative. White tells us that historical enactment is given to us as narrative mimesis, with its success given as the correspondence of history to some lived reality. Ernst counters by giving us enactment in the form of playback. In an essay called Telling Versus Counting, A Media Archaeological Point of View, Ernst plays with the notion that to tell as a transitive verb means to count things. The contrast with White here relates to the difference in the German words erzählen, which means narrate, and zählen, which means to count. But you also find it in English, recount and count. Ernst describes historians as recounters. Modern historians are obliged not just to order data as in antiquaries, but also to propose models of relations between them, to interpret plausible connections between events. In another essay aptly titled Method and Machine Versus the History and Narrative of Media, Ernst adds that mainstream histories of technology and mass media, as well as their counter histories, are textual performances that follow a chronological and narrative ordering of events. He observes succinctly that it takes machines to temporarily liberate us from such limitations. Where do we go with Ernst's declaration in Telling Versus Counting that there can be order without stories? We go, of course, directly to the machines. For Ernst, media machines are transparent in their operation, an advantage denied to historians. We play back historical media on historical machines, and quote, all of a sudden, the historian's desire to preserve the original sources of the past comes true at the sacrifice of the discursive. We are in that moment directly in contact with the past. In Method and Machine, Ernst offers the concept of media irony as a response to White's trope of historical irony. He says, media irony, the awareness of the media as co-producers of cultural content with the medium evidently part of the message, is a technological modification of Hayden White's notion that every discourse is always as much about discourse itself as it is about the objects that make up its subject matter. As opposed to recounting, counting, in Ernst's view, has to do with the encoding and decoding of signals by media machines. Naturally, humans created these machines. This might be considered as another irony because humans have thereby created a discontinuity with their own cultural regime. We are in a realm that replaces narrative with playback as a form of direct access to a past defined by machine sequences rather than historical time. Ahrens draws implications from media archaeology for his closely connected notion of the multimedia archive. In Method and Machine, he says, with digital archives, there is in principle no more delay between memory and the present, but rather the technical option of immediate feedback, turning all present data into archival entries and vice versa. In Telling versus Counting, he portrays, quote, a truly multimedia archive that stores images using an image-based method and sound in its own medium. And finally, for the first time in media history, one can archive a technological dispositif in its own medium. Not only is the enactment of history based on playback inherently non-discursive, but the very structure of historical knowledge is written by machines. With this as background, we can turn to the concrete manifestation of Ahrens' ideas about the multimedia archive. This is the lab he has created in Berlin. The website for Ahrens' lab describes the Media Archaeological Fundus, MAF, as a collection of various electromechanical and mechanical artifacts as they developed throughout time. Its aim is to provide a perspective that may inspire modern thinking about technology and media within its epistemological implications beyond historiography. Ahrens explained the intention behind the MAF in an interview with Laurie Emerson as deriving from the need to experience media in performative ways. So he created an assemblage of media and media technologies that could be operated, touched, manipulated, and studied directly. He said in this interview, such items need to be displayed in action to reveal their media essentiality. Otherwise, a medium like a TV set is nothing but a piece of furniture. Here is an indirect response after 25 years to the AFIPS brochure's statement that artifacts are like the furnishings in a preserved house. Okay, there we go. The media archaeological take, I'm having trouble with that word today for some reason. It's not resistance on the part of the historian, I assure you. The media archaeological take on enacting history depends on access to artifacts, and it's in its strongest form on their operation. Even when its engagement with media history is reduced to texts, these must be tested against the material evidence. This is the use case for playback as an enactment of software history. So let's go to take three, the reenactor. Authenticity is an important concept for digital preservation. A key feature of any digital archive over the preservation lifecycle of its documents and software objects is auditing and verification of authenticity, as in any archive. Access also involves authenticity, as any discussion of emulation or virtualization will bring up the question of fidelity to an historical experience of using software. John Walker, of Autodesk and virtual reality fame, created a workshop called Formilab to work on personal projects such as an online museum celebrating Charles Babbage's analytical engine. This computer programming heritage work includes historical documents and a Java-based emulator of the engine. Walker writes, since we're fortunate enough to live in a world where Babbage's dream has been belatedly realized, albeit in silicon rather than brass, we can not only read about the analytical engine, but experience it for ourselves. The authenticity of this experience, whatever that means for a machine that never existed, was important to him. In a 4,500-word essay titled, Is the Emulator Authentic?, Walker tells us that in order to be useful, an emulator program must be authentic. It must faithfully replicate the behavior of the machine it is emulating. By extension, the authenticity of a preserved version of the computer game Doom in a digital repository could be audited by verifying that it can properly run a Doom demo file or a replay file. The same is true for Microsoft Word and a historical document in the Word format. This is a machine-centered notion of authenticity, We used it in the second Preserving Virtual Worlds project as a solution to the significant properties problem for software. All well and good. However, I want to address a different authenticity today. Rather than judging authenticity in terms of playback, I would like to ask what authenticity means for the experience of using software. Another way of putting this question is to ask what we are looking for in the reenactment of historical software use. So we need to think about historical reenactment. Now, I'm not a historical reenactor, at least not the kind you're thinking of. I've never participated in the live recreation or performance of an historical event. I have been playing historical simulations, a category of board games, for most of my life, so perhaps you could say that I reenact being a historical military officer by staring at maps and moving units around on them. It's not the same thing as wearing period uniforms and living the life, however. Anyway, I need a reenactor. In his 1998 book, Confederates in the Attic, Tony Horowitz described historical reenactment in its relationship to lived heritage. His participant journal reportage begins at a chance encounter with a group of hardcore Confederate reenactors, hardcore is in scare quotes. Their conversation leads Horowitz on a year-long voyage through the American South. A featured character in Confederates in the Attic is the reenactor Robert Lee Hodge, a waiter turned Confederate officer. He took Horowitz under his wing and provided basic training in reenactment. Hodge even became a minor celebrity due to his role in the book. Hodges teaches Horowitz the difference between hardcore and Farby, i.e. more casual, reenactment. He tells Horowitz about dieting to look sufficiently gaunt and malnourished, the basics of bloating to resemble a corpse on the battlefield, what to wear, what not to wear, what to eat, what not to eat, and so on. It's remarkable how little time he spends on martial basics. One moment sticks out for me. During the night after a hard day of campaigning, Horowitz finds himself in the authentic situation of being wet, cold, and hungry. He lacks a blanket, so he's given basic instruction in the sleeping technique of the Confederate infantrymen called spooning. Yeah. The reenactor Scott Cross informs us in his aptly titled The Art of Spooning, 1989, that spooning is an old term for bundling up together in bed like spoons placed together in a silver chest. Makes sense. Soldiers bunch up to keep warm. So that's what Horowitz does, quite uncomfortably. It interested me that of all the reenactment activities Horowitz describes, spooning reveals a deeper commitment to authenticity than any of the combat performances. It's uncomfortable and awkward, so requires conscious effort. Sleep becomes self-conscious activity rather than sleep. Since greater numbers of participants are needed for reenacting a battle than sleep, more Farbs show up, and thus the general level of engagement declines. During stage battles, spectators, scripting, confusion, and accidents all interfere with the experience. Immersion breaks whenever dead soldiers popped up on the command, resurrect. I suspect that many Farbs dressed up for battle find a hotel to sleep in. Specific attention to the details of daily life might be a reflection of recent historical work that emphasizes social and cultural histories of the Civil War period rather than combat histories, but that's not my takeaway from the spooning reenactors. Rather, it's the standard of authenticity that goes beyond performance of a specific event, such as a battle, to include life experience as a whole. Horowitz recalled that between gulps of coffee, which the men insisted on drinking from their own tin cups rather than our ceramic mugs, Kuhl and his comrades explained the distinction. Hardcores don't just dress up and shoot blanks. They sought absolute fidelity to the 1860s, its homespun clothing, antique speech patterns, sparse diet, and simple utensils. Adhered to properly, this fundamentalism produced a time travel hire, what hardcores called a period rush. Stephen Gapps, an Australian curator, historian, and reenactor, coincidentally I'm meeting him on Monday, has spoken of the extraordinary lengths reenactors go to acquire and animate the look and feel of history. Hardcore is not just about marching, shooting, and swordplay. So I wonder what a period rush might be for the experience of playing pitfall in the mid-21st century. Shag rugs, ambient new wave radio, caffeine-free cola, if anybody remembers that. Will future reenactors of historical software seek this level of experiential fidelity? Gaps again. Although reenactors invoke the standard of authenticity, they also understand that it is elusive, worth striving for, but never really attainable. So reenactment offers a take on born digital heritage that proposes a commitment to lived experience. I see some similarity here with the correspondence to lived historical experience in White's striving for discursive mimesis. Yet, like media archaeology, reenactment puts performance above discourse, though it is the performance of humans rather than machines. Okay, we now have three different ways to think about potential uses of historical software and born digital documentation. I'll shift my historian's hat to one side of my head now and slide up my curator's cap. If we consider these takes as use cases, do they help us decide how to allocate resources to acquire, preserve, describe, and provide access to digital collections? In May 2013, the National Digital Information Infrastructure and Preservation Program, quite a mouthful, NDIP, of the U.S. Library of Congress, henceforth LC, held a conference called Preserving.exe. The agenda was to articulate the problems and opportunities of software preservation. In my contribution to the LC conference report issued a few months later, I described three lures of software preservation. These are potential pitfalls as we move from software collections to digital repositories and from there to programs of access to software collections. The second half of my talk today will be an attempt to introduce the three lures of software preservation to the three takes on historical enactment. A quick disclaimer first. Nothing I say today is intended, I mean this sincerely, is intended as a criticism of any specific projects. Okay, on to the three lures. Let's begin with the lure of the screen. This is the idea that what counts in digital media is what is delivered to the screen. This lure pops up in software preservation whenever we evaluate significant properties of software as surface properties, graphics, audio, haptics, etc. This lure of the screen is related to what media studies scholars such as Nick Montfort, Mark Sample, and Matt Kirschenbaum have dubbed in various but related contexts as screen essentialism. If the significant properties of software are all surface properties, then our perception of interaction with software tells us all we need to know. We check graphics, audio, responses to our use of controllers, etc. And if they look and act as they should, we have succeeded in preserving an executable version of historical software. These properties are arguably the properties that designers consider as the focus of user interaction, and they are the easiest to inspect and verify directly. The second Preserving Virtual Worlds project was concerned primarily with identifying significant properties of interactive game software. On the basis of several case sets and interviews with developers and other stakeholders, we concluded that isolating surface properties, such as image color space as one example, while significant for other media such as static images, is not a particularly useful approach to take for game software. With interactive software, significance appears to be variable and contextual, as one would expect from a medium in which content is expressed through a mixture of design and play, procedurality, and emergence. It is especially important that software abstraction levels are not visible on the surface of play. It is difficult, if not impossible, to monitor procedural aspects of game design and mechanics, programming, and technology by inspecting properties expressed on the screen. The preservation lifecycle for software is likely to include data migration. Access to migrated software will probably occur through emulation. How do we know when our experience of this software is affected by these practices? One answer is that we audit significant properties, and as we now know, it will be difficult to predict which characteristics are significant. An alternative or companion approach for auditing the operation of historical software is to verify the execution of data files, as I mentioned earlier. The integrity of the software can be evaluated by comparison to documented disk images or file signatures, such as hashes or checksums. However, when data migration or delivery environments change the software or its execution environment, this method is inadequate. We must evaluate software performance. Instead of asking whether the software looks right, We can check if it runs verified data sets that meet the specifications of the original software. Examples range from word processing documents to saved game and replay files. Of course, visual inspection of the content plays a role in verifying execution by the software engine. Failure will not always be clearly indicated by crashes or error messages. Eliminating screen essentialism does not erase surface properties altogether. The three takes compel us to think about the screen problem in different ways. First, the historian is not troubled by screen essentialism at all. His construction of a narrative mimesis invokes a selection of source materials that may or may not involve close reading of personal gameplay, let alone focus on surface properties. On the other hand, the reenactor's use of software might lead repositories to fret about what the user sees, hears, and feels. It makes sense with this use case to think about the reenactment as occurring at the interface. If a repository aims to deliver a reenacted screen experience, it will need to delve deeply into questions of significant properties and their preservation. Screen essentialism is also a potential problem for repositories that follow the path of media archaeology. It is unclear to me how a research site like the MAF, Wolfgang Ernst Lab, would respond to digital preservation practices based on data migration and emulation. Can repositories meet the requirements of media archaeologists without making a commitment to preservation of working historical hardware to enable playback from original media? It's not just that correspondence to surface characteristics is a significant property for media archaeologists, nor is the lure of the screen a criticism of media archaeology. I propose instead that it is a research problem. Ernst's vision of a multimedia archive is based on the idea that media archaeology moves beyond playback to reveal mechanisms of counting. This machine operation clearly is not a surface characteristic. Ernst would argue, I think, that this counting is missed by an account of what is seen on the screen. So let's assign the task of accounting for counting to the media archaeologist, which means showing us how abstraction layers and software below the surface can be revealed, audited, and studied. The second lure, the lure of the authentic experience. I've already said quite a bit about authenticity. Let me explain now why I'm skeptical about an authentic experience of historical software, and why this is an important problem for software collections. Everyone in game or software studies knows about emulation. Emulation projects struggle to recreate an authentic experience of operating a piece of software, such as playing a game. Authenticity here means that the use experience today is like it was. The lure of the authentic experience tells digital repositories, at minimum, not to preserve software in a manner that would interfere with the production of such experiences. At maximum, repositories deliver authentic experiences, whether on-site or online. This is a tall order. In the minimum case, the repository provides software and collects hardware specifications, drivers, or support programs. The documentation provides software and hardware specifications. Researchers use this documentation to reconstruct the historical look and feel of software to which they have access. In the maximum case, the repository designs and builds access environments. Using the software authentically would then probably mean a trip to the library or museum with historical or bespoke hardware. The reading room becomes the site of the experience. I'm not happy to debunk the authentic experience. Authenticity is a concept fraught not just with intellectual issues, but with registers ranging from nostalgia and fandom to immersion and fun. Frankly, it's a minefield. The first problem is perhaps an academic point, but nonetheless important. Authenticity is always constructed. Whose lived experience counts as authentic, and how has it been documented? Is the best source a developer's design notes, the memory of someone who used the software when it was released, a marketing video, the researcher's self-reflexive use in a library or museum? If a game was designed for kids in 1985, do you have to find a kid to play it in 2050? In the case of software with a long history, such as Breakout or Microsoft Word, how do we account for the fact that the software was used on a variety of platforms? Do repositories have to account for all of them? For example, does the playing of Doom Deathmatch require peer-to-peer networking on a local area network, a mouse and keyboard control configuration, and a CRT display? There are documented cases of different configurations of hardware for Doom, trackballs, hacks that enabled multiplayer via TCP/IP, monitors of various shapes and sizes, and so on. Which differences matter? A second problem is that the authentic experience is not always that useful to the researcher, especially the researcher studying how historical software executes under the hood. The emulated version of a software program often compensates for its lack of authenticity by offering real-time information about system states and code execution. A trade-off for losing authenticity thus occurs when the emulator shows the underlying machine operation, the counting, if you will. What questions will historians of technology, practitioners of code studies, or game scholars ask about historical software? I suspect that many researchers will be as interested in how the software works as in a personal experience deemed authentic. As for more casual appreciation, the Guggenheim Singh Double Exhibition and Margaret Hedstrom's studies of emulation suggest that exhibition visitors actually prefer reworked or updated experiences of historical software. This is not to say that original artifacts, both physical and virtual, will not be a necessary part of the research process. Access to original technology provides evidence regarding its constraints and affordances. I put this to you not as a one-size-fits-all decision, but as an area of institutional choice based on objectives and resources. The reenactor, of course, is deeply committed to the authentic experience. If all we offer is emulation, what do we say to him besides, sorry? Few digital repositories will be preoccupied with delivering authentic experiences as part of their core activity. A better use of limited resources would be to ensure that validated software artifacts and contextual information are available to researchers who do this work on a case-by-case basis. Horwitz credits Robert Lee Hodge with an enormous amount of research time spent at the National Archives and Library of Congress. Research with photographs and documents is behind his reenactments. Repository should, with apologies to Manny Ramirez, if anybody here knows who Manny Ramirez is, let reenactors be the reenactors. Consider this scenario for software reenactment. You are playing an Atari VCS game with the open source Stella emulator. It bothers you that viewing the game on your LCD display differs from the experience with the 1980s era television set. You're motivated by this realization to contribute code to the Stella project for emulating a historical display. It is theoretically possible that you could assemble everything needed to create an experience that satisfies you, an old television, adapters, an original VCS, the software, etc. By the way, let's not worry about the shag rug and the lava lamp. You can create this personal experience on your own, then write code that matches it. My question, would the result be less authentic if you relied on historical documentation such as video, screenshots, technical specifications, and other evidence available in a repository to describe the original experience? My point is that repositories can cooperatively support research by reenactors who create their version of the experience. Digital repositories should consider the authentic experience as more of a research problem than a repository problem. Finally, the lure of the executable, lure number three. The lure of the executable evaluates software preservation in terms of success at building collections of software that can be executed on demand by researchers. Why do we collect historical software? Of course, the reason is that computer software and digital data have had a profound impact on virtually every aspect of recent history. Well, what should we collect? David Behrman's answer in 1987 was the software archive. He distinguished this archive from what I will call the software library. The archive assembles documentation. The library provides historical software. The archive was a popular choice in the early days. Margaret Hedstrom reported that attendees at the 1990 Arden Conference, I was there, on the preservation of microcomputer software debated whether it was necessary to preserve software itself in order to provide a sense of touch and feel, or whether the history of software development could be documented with more traditional records, I'm quoting her. In 2002, the Smithsonian's David Allison wrote about collecting historical software in museums that, quoting him, supporting materials are often more valuable for historical study than code itself. They provide contextual information that is critical to evaluating the historical significance of the software products, end quote. He concluded that operating software is not a high priority for historical museums. Again, institutional resources are not as limitless as the things we would like to do with software. Curators must prioritize among collections and services. The choice between software archive and library is not strictly binary, but choices still must be made. I spent quite a bit of my professional life in software preservation projects. The end product of these projects is, at least in part, the library of executable historical software. I understand the lure of the executable and the reasons that compel digital repositories to build collections of verified historical software that can be executed on demand by researchers. This is the holy grail of digital curation with respect to software history. What could possibly be wrong with this mission if it can be executed? As I've argued on other occasions, there are several problems to consider. Let me give you two. The first is that software does not tell the user very much about how it has previously been used. In the best case, application software in its original use environment might display a record of recent files created by previous users, such as the list of recently opened files found in many productivity titles like Microsoft Office. The more typical situation is that software in a repository is freshly installed from data files and thus completely lacks information about its biography, for want of a better term. The second related problem is fundamental. Documentation that is a prerequisite for historical studies of software is rarely located in software. It is more accurate to say that this documentation surrounds software in development archives, including source code, and records of use and reception. It is important to understand that this is not just a problem for historical research. Documentation is also a problem for repositories. If contextual information, such as software dependencies or descriptions of relationships among objects, is not available to the repository, and all the retired software engineers who knew the software inside and out are gone, it may be impossible to get old software to run. Well, the reenactor will want to run software. The media archaeologist will not just want access to a software library, but to original media and hardware in working order. Good luck with that, by the way. Ask 100 historians, however, and I predict that at least 99 of them will be satisfied with the archive. In Best Before, Video Games, Supersession, and Obsolescence, James Newman is not optimistic about software preservation, and he describes how the marketing of software has in some ways made it a near impossibility. He's not as pessimistic about video game history, however. In a section of his book provocatively called Let Video Games Die, he argues that a documentary approach to gameplay might be a more pragmatic enterprise than the effort to preserve playable games. He sees this as, and I'm quoting, a shift away from conceiving of play as the outcome of preservation to a position that acknowledges play as an indivisible part of the object of preservation. In other words, what happens when we record contemporary use of software to create historical documentation of that use? Does this activity potentially reduce the need for services that provide for use at any given time in the future? This strikes me as a plausible historical use case, but not one for reenactment or media archaeology. Boy, am I having trouble with that word today. Must be the jet lag. Software archives or software libraries? That is the question. Is it nobler to collect documentation or to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous software installations? The case for documentation is strong. The consensus among library and museum curators, like myself, who have taken a side, is that documents from source code to screenshots are a clear win for historical studies of software. Historians will not be the only visitors to the archive. As I've noted, there's even a software library case to be made for archives, since successful software preservation depends on documentation. Documents tell reenactors how software was used, and they can help media archaeologists figure out what they are hearing or seeing when it works. But does it replace the software library? A good question for further discussion. I'll leave it at that. My goal today has been to give you some use cases and repository choices to consider. Historian, media archaeologist, or reenactor? Archives or libraries? Let the conversations about these choices begin. Thank you. What next? Stay here? Okay. Wonderful. I hope I asked enough questions.
Hi. I noticed in your reenactment slide you had a photo from the SCA, right? As it happens, I'm a founder member of the SCA in Australia, and
somebody would show.
Okay. No, there's no need to be afraid because we're not really about reenactment in an authentic style, okay? And if you read Confederates in the Attic, you know that these discussions can go on forever, but I'll just summarize very briefly. For reenactment, you can reenact the equipment, you can reenact the techniques, and you can reenact the speed or ferocity of the combat. So in the SEA, we only do one, right? They're not real weapons, they're just rattan. They're not real techniques, they're stuff we make up because it works. But you put that together with being able to fight at full speed and you get the authenticity that we want for that particular event, right? But you cannot recreate the thing properly, otherwise people would be dead. Right, and this is a problem even for the most hardcore Confederate reenactors. Nobody dies. You mentioned the Resurrection Command, right? Nobody dies. So I take your point entirely that, you know, the authenticity is unattainable in any real historical reenactment of any sort for hardware or for software. My question, I suppose, for the questions you asked about software and the supporting materials. I mean, we made a lot of software. We've still got software. Nobody told us to keep anything else, right? Nobody told us to keep the documentations, the working papers, the drafts of rule books or anything else. And I suspect that throughout the industry, that's very common practice. So how do we deal with the fact that when we were making it, nobody told us it was history and there might not be a lot left?
Okay, a couple of things there. First thing, I need to scold you for not having read that 1978 brochure. It said there you should keep it, right? You're quite right. Let me go to the point about reenactment. What you said is exactly what I get from historical reenactment. The problem is that there is, the idea is to take that notion of historical reenactment as you described it, as something limited, as looking for another goal about experience, which need not be the authentic experience in a literal sense. It may be something about using that as a springboard for a certain kind of experience today that's immersive and fun and has certain criteria that you've established. There are many people who react to emulators, for example, and dismiss emulators because they feel that that experience is not authentic in some sense. And so what I'm trying to do is inject the attitude that you expressed about historical, about the SCA, for example, mm-hmm. and try to inject that into the feelings that we have towards reenacting historical software, to get away from the idea that because it's software, because we can execute that software, we can duplicate the experience somehow. And I'm saying it doesn't matter if you can duplicate the execution, you still can't duplicate the experience, right? Why weren't people told to preserve documentation? I guess I disagree with that a little bit in that there actually has been quite a bit of documentation that was preserved. But I do think, but at the same time, partly I do agree with you because we have had similar problems in really all areas of high technology. And it has a lot to do with the pace of innovation, the pace of change, the kinds of organizations and businesses and academic institutions that have responded to those changes in technology and so forth. So that the reason is, I think it's not so much that you weren't told, but even if you had been told, you wouldn't have had time to deal with it. And that's not something I'm making up on the cuff. That's something I've been told many, many times by people in industry who sort of said, "Oh my God, I wish I'd done this," but there really was no time to consider these things. And that means that it's the role of the archivists and historians and museum curators to get in there and to make contacts with people they've identified as potentially having important historical records and sort of, you know, getting in there and reminding them about what they have and trying to make some kind of, to try to reach in and do the best that they can to preserve those records. But yeah, I think it's really more a sign of the times and the kind of rapid-paced world that we live in, especially with regard to the rapid changes in the technology we'd like to document that are responsible for that.
Okay, thank you. Just on a related note then about this authenticity and recreating things, when, you know, we made games in the 80s, for instance, and we put graphics on the screen, we thought they were really good. They were really good, right? And people who played those games thought they were really good. But how can anybody today look at those graphics, however emulated, and think that they're really good? Right, to me that seems impossible. So you cannot divorce yourself from all the subsequent experience of graphics in games with its hyper-accelerated improvement and sit down and say, "Oh, actually, no, I think those graphics are really good," because they're not. They're crap.
So I have two different responses to that. First, the historians, and then maybe the general player's response to that. The historian's response to that. You are from SSG by any chance,
yes,
are you?
Yes.
Okay. Well, as a historian, I would go back and look at SSG and look at the structure of the games and the opening up of possibilities about designing scenarios and players making their own games and things like that. And I would find historically that's quite important, and especially in the 1980s, if one is the way the history is being told, there's very little recognition of the availability of that kind of a play experience in the 1980s, which was something that, as I'm sure you know, board games had already introduced to a certain extent before that. So for a historian to appreciate why is that a good game, I think is very easy. They're historically important things were happening that need to be appreciated. For the general player, it's tough. And I've had this experience with numerous games where I've gone back, you know, I said, "Oh, I need to play Warcraft 1 and Warcraft 2 because it's something that I'm doing." And it's just agony. And I don't really know what to say about that. I think my suspicion is that it's probably true of the majority of games that were heavily dependent on various ways of creating an immersive experience around graphics and audio, that it's just not worth it. Just do a remake of the game or do a different game. But the more you go into things like strategy types of games or games that involve very basic gameplay that don't depend too much on the evolution of those surface characteristics, you know, the audio, the video, and so on, I think there might be a chance with some games. And I have to admit, I've actually gone back to some of your games, and I've been able to play them, which I was not able to do. When I say able to play them, I mean the experience kept me going. And I will say with Warcraft 1, I could not do it. You know, there was just a difference in, there's some very subtle differences there in the way the experience is delivered, what you're focused on, what your gameplay involves. How to assess that for a general player, I don't know. But as far as a historian goes, I think there are criteria that make games of the 1980s very valuable and essential to be familiar with.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry?
Is there another response as well, another take as a fan?
Yes, as a fan. Now, so I'll be, you know, I'll be, you're my friends, I'll be very honest with you. I've been playing games my entire life, which is a very long time, board games, beginning with board games. And fandom is still something that, of the sort I think you're describing, something is still kind of elusive to me. I've never, today I There's some historical games I like to play, but I'm very excited by contemporary games as they come up, and I never play a game because of I liked it then. Now, not speaking as a historian, my appreciation is entirely rooted in today, my experience of the games today. I'm probably not the best person to ask about fandom. Fan memory of games. I think that's actually, I can only give you a personal take on that. It's not really a historian's question. I think that's best experienced through documentation, frankly. I think the gameplay, your first girlfriend, when you were 15, what would you rather do? See photographs of that time and things that remind you of that time, or actually meet the person again? I don't know. It's sort of like it can be disappointing. It can be a letdown, right? It's not the way you remembered it. And the game may not be the way you remember it. But go back to the documentation, the magazines that you have about that game, the community experiences you had playing the game. Today you might go back. I know for me, I go back to conventions where these are board games, but the conventions where I played, or maybe I won a tournament or something. I still have correspondence from games that I played by mail, and I go through those, and through that documentation, I have very strong memories that I very much enjoy of playing of those games. I suspect in some of those cases, if not all of them, actually going back to play the game would probably be the wrong thing to do. It probably would be less fun from that point of view than the documentation.
More that the documentation of fandom from the time can shed a light on.
Possibly, sure. I never rule out anything. I'm only, as I criticize these options, the perspective is the one that I laid out in the talk. There are just a lot of choices that we have. And some choices I may choose not to make because they don't speak to me or to my institution's needs, but another institution or another person to whom that does speak should be doing that. And if they're doing something different for what I'm doing, all the better.
I want to add an idea to your ideas of historical enactment, but first, because it's a good occasion to pick up the last talk about what will players of today think of games from yesterday, and I will support Henry's view by an observation everyone can do in our exhibition. I'm coming from the Computer Game Museum in Berlin, that the kids don't care too much about if it's an old game or not. So they like to play the games, the old arcade games as well as the games of today. I agree that graphics doesn't matter too much, but what may be more important is difficulty, for example. Today you have much more casual gamers than you used to had in earlier times, and the difficulty usually was quite hard back then. And so that's different, but that's more related to gameplay, and so that's what Henry already said. I want to also add an idea how I see that historical enactment became important for preserving games, especially if you think of multiplayer online games, which are consist very much of the social interaction. And one can consider a World of Warcraft in the future. In 50 years, we will be able to emulate the whole server structure, and then you go into World of Warcraft, but what you will see are only non-player characters. And of course, this is not World of Warcraft. And so I see that could become another meaning of historic enactment, that you have people doing a raid then in this preserved online environments, and you might have spectators joining a guided tour, and then somebody explaining to them what they see there, or maybe you, of course, are invited to join this raid, and that might become another important meaning of that.
Yeah, you know, your mark reminds me of something that I probably should have said more clearly. This isn't thought about enough. There's a big difference in thinking about access to games of the 1980s in 2015, when people who play the games, even people who design the games, aren't really... there's some people who've moved on, but most people are still around. A lot of people who play the games are still around. versus 2050, when none of those people will be around. That's a big difference. I mean, the nostalgia factor, for example, is gone as a direct kind of motivation. People can be nostalgic, of course, about things they didn't experience, but it's a different kind of nostalgia. And I don't think we talk about that enough. We talk a lot about these issues with our frame of references being today vis-a-vis historical software, but we don't talk about it enough in terms of the future vis-a-vis historical software, when a lot of the resources, particularly human resources we have available to us today to understand what was going on in the 1980s with software, playing, making it, and so on. None of that will be around 50 years from now. So what will we put into place to substitute for that? And again, that's why documentation is so important.
I find it really peculiar that when we talk about games, we create these different rules and frameworks with which to discuss them. You talk about other media, like film, for example, or television. If I watch a TV show from the 50s that's on cable, I'm not necessarily being nostalgic. I'm watching that show because I enjoy it, and there are aesthetic reasons. Same with film. I can watch Citizen Kane or one of the classical Hollywood greats and still appreciate it not only as a historical object but as an aesthetic object that has its own enjoyment. And with games, yes, there's the question of accessibility because of the technology, but, you know, with emulation and so on, and there's a huge move now with the retro gaming, I think a similar kind of thing is taking place. And Andreas just mentioned that, you know, kids come to the museum and they can enjoy the earlier games as much as they enjoy the present ones. And I'm really interested in why we have to set up this kind of nostalgia. It has to be about nostalgia and about revisiting the past, as opposed to the fact that we're living in an age where the entire history of the media is available to us. You know, we can watch the whole history of the movies by, you know, downloading, or it's on telly or DVDs. And the same is happening with games, and it's not necessarily about nostalgia alone. I mean, kids now play Pac-Man and they weren't even born during that period.
Yeah, it's funny. I just finished teaching a course at Stanford with co-taught it with Scott Buchapman, who's a film scholar, on media and message. It's a freshman course, so we have young students, and we find ourselves in a given lecture interrupting ourselves maybe 10 times a lecture to ask people what they've heard of. You know, have you heard of Judy Garland? You know, there's some reference, and of course nobody has. That kind of thing. And it's interesting. We talk a lot in that class, and so it's kind of fresh on my mind at the moment, about the differences in the ways that an 18, 19-year-old today has available to them to view historical content as well as contemporary content, and whether that makes a difference or not. I do think that there are some important differences in the ways that older linear media are being viewed that do have an effect, and not so much... the specific media differences, say, between watching in a movie theater and watching on a DVD or on a laptop or something like that, but more the layering of interface over media content, you know, when you're watching on YouTube or something like that, or the layering of social media on top of the viewing experience, those sorts of things, which are quite profoundly different. And there have been some studies now about the huge generational difference, or the huge generational differences in the reactions to those layerings. It's quite remarkable how different, say, a 60-year-old is with respect to whether they want social media to be involved in what they're watching, or, you know, they want to have to deal with something where they can choose to change the speed of the film or something like that versus a 20-year-old. It's really quite remarkable how different they are. So I think those kinds of differences do come up. I think I'm a little less optimistic about the engagement with retro, with historical games. There is evidence, I have a lot of word-of-mouth evidence, and there have been some studies that exhibitions of retro games have not always succeeded for a variety of reasons, that there are some strong preferences for reworked versions very often in museum settings. And there are also, as the Seeing Double exhibition showed, some real technical issues to think about with that as well. But I do applaud, I mean, what your basic point is, we should be looking at all of these media not in isolation, but seeing the ways in which looking at each of them can offer some interesting insights for other media. And I think that's a super important point. And, you know, let's hope it happens.
Just to make a bit of a bid for... Hi.
Hi, there you are.
Couldn't get much higher than up here. Just a bit of a bid for oral history as a way of capturing a strong sense of nostalgia in people who are actually talking about the nostalgia, I would guess, and generally oral history anyway as a very powerful way of recording, documenting possibly, but in a way that's in the popular voice, I guess. Mm-hmm. That there was an interesting thing I read about agricultural labourer techniques in 19th century England, that they were retrieved, the knowledge was actually retrieved from oral histories. And though perhaps like museums collect computer games, museums also will have collected the tools. There are literally hundreds of techniques that just a commoner garden agricultural labourer would have used. So I think the sort of and how they might have been used and the kind of life they led and the cycles through they lived through. So I guess there's you can draw a picture a lot wider than perhaps we're doing sometimes in terms of what we're collecting. And what we preserve, and possibly, and how we might encourage people without who weren't born even to actually be able to appreciate a little bit more about the experience and reproduce some of it through their own experience. Then,
mm-hmm. Oral history is a huge, huge win for any kind of historical or heritage project. There's the obvious thing. Of course, you're getting information that you might not ever find in any documentation. But let me tell you about a couple of the other things that come along with that. We've had several oral history projects at Stanford I've been involved with, also at the Computer History Museum. And also we've used interviews in some of our research projects. One thing is that oral history also benefits documentation collection. If you're working on a project and you're interviewing people, you almost always find out about documentation that they've tucked in the garage or something like that. So you end up not only supplementing the documentation record because of you're finding out about things that aren't in it, but you're also getting more documentation usually as a result of them. Another thing is the communication that it sets up between the researcher and the community of people involved in something goes past the interview. You know, people stay in touch. Somebody you interview comes and speaks to your class. So now they're talking to students. That has its own dynamic and its own value. You can have different kinds of interviewers. You can have people, you might have somebody who's also expert in the field of the person you're interviewing, and that leads to a certain kind of conversation that is captured as part of the oral history or the interview. So there are quite a few things that happen as a result of oral histories that kind of reverberate outside of the oral history itself beyond the transcript that you end up getting from that interview.
Absolutely.
It's a wonderful a technique. I hope, you know, every heritage or historical project should definitely be involved in oral history, and there should be, as much recognition of that as possible. So thanks for bringing it up.
Hi.
Hi.
Great keynote. Really wonderful. I've got a two-prong. I'll keep it short though. I really loved your comments about Hayden White, and I think about him a lot, especially in regards to the way the work gets used and misused and then misinterpreted at the time. I'm thinking especially about people like Carlo Ginzburg, who reflected on that work and said, well, this is way off base, this is going to lead us into these horrendous, very oral and human experiences of history. And then thinking about the two new books about game history, Rayford Gwynn's and James Newman that came out recently, and thinking about their very different positions on how to present and represent game history. I'm wondering how you see perhaps this kind of these cases being made for these contextual kind of slices of history being built together, especially in context in, and I know you know about this, you've spoken about it, but the companies, especially in Japan, like Capcom, presenting their old games in a context of like a virtual bedroom with like Bon Jovi playing, and you know they've got the Capcom Classics collection, and you've got 8-track, and your console games and your Atari games are all like in a flashback scenario. So I'm wondering if you've got, can just expand a little bit on Hayden White's concepts in reference to those ideas of like corporate collections of history that are represented in that way. If that makes sense, and I'm kind of thinking about the reception of Hayden White's work more generally in your comments.
So you mean what would he think about the narrative that's constructed by, in a sense, the participant? And that would also tie in a little bit, I suppose, with Ginsberg, right?
Because I think, and I'm just thinking about the way that, you know, Newman's book, you know, they're both fantastic books, but Newman comes out really with an axe to grind about a perceived lack of one type of approach that makes a case for it. And Rayford Gwynn's just comes out with much more detail and says, look, there's all these other projects going on. Yeah,
you know, I haven't thought about the question you're asking. It's kind of interesting. I guess part of much of the answer would be revolve around what the results of those projects are. Because remember, White does allow, there's other kinds of historical narrative besides history, right? So I would expect that a Capcom presentation of the history of their games, way of getting to that content and so on, might end up being kind of like a chronicle. You know, first there was this, and then there was this, and then there was that, and then there was that. And it might give you, you know, a few insights into the times and things like that. But it would still end up ultimately being just a an ordering of those events according to a chronology or something like that. It might resemble an autobiography, you know, another kind of narrative historical primary source that's constructed. This is the life of Capcom, you know, and the presenting, ordering the events of that life according to, you know, this game and that game and, you know, this begat that and so forth and so on. I think it would be a very, very high bar to set to expect a historical narrative a la White to emerge from a participant, you know, company as a participant kind of historical project like that. For a company to be able to present a historical argument like the kind of argument that White challenges historians to produce, that would be a very high bar indeed. Which is not to say it wouldn't be useful, because chronicles are useful, annals are useful. Those sorts of things sit as historical sources that are available give insights, give documentation that historians can use, and so forth. So it's laudable, but I think it would be extremely difficult for that to emerge as a true sort of historical discourse in the sense that White asks for. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay, good.
I think that, just with that in mind, I think that the Capcom Square Enix especially try, and in Japanese language, they don't do it in a way you recognize, because they focus on artwork and books rather than software.
Hey, you know, it's got the word history here. It's a history, let's say with a small H, and let's say White is a history with a capital H or something like that. Okay.
I think the mic is up for that.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, sorry. I just thought I'd give you a little case study from SSG's history and today, right? A practical problem that we have right now. So in the 90s, we're not sure, sorry, historians, late 80s maybe, we made a game called Gold with the Americas about colonization, the New World. You can still run that game today under DOSBox on current machines. That's no problem. Now, my colleague Roger and I teach at TAFE as well, and we have some very bright students, and we want to do a new version of this game, and we gave it to one of our students to have a look at. And his very first response was he was surprised, if not shocked, to find that there was no tutorial. There's no tutorial. We expected you to read the manual, right? The game did not take you by the hand and say, this is your explorer, you have to move him over here to, well, let's call it Virginia, right? The game just sits there and waits for you to use the game. And so, in a sense, yes, you could put that on display today and people could play it, but they can't because they're not going to read the manual, right? That is a foreign experience to them, and it was to him. And we are seriously looking at remaking that game, but of course now it's not going to be the same game for those very reasons. We would have to now do the hand-holding if we wanted to sell more than 10 copies and totally change how the game presents itself to the user. So if you've got, you know, a side-scrolling platform game in a museum, everybody can play those. If you've got a more complex game from that original era, I don't think anybody can play them. They're not going to sit down and read 30 pages of the manual to find out what to do.
Yeah, let me tell you about a very similar experience that I had, because this was eye-opening for me. One of my former students, very good Stanford student, now has a PhD in game studies from another institution. He is an independent game designer, digital game designer, brilliant guy. We'd been talking for years. He knew I played board games, and we'd been talking for years, and Twilight Struggle had come out from GMT, which was a very, you know, for a relatively hardcore kind of war game, board game, was quite successful. A lot of people were interested in it. And the game after it came out, called Labyrinth, and he said, hey, let's play that together. I said, sure. So I set it up at home. He got a copy of the rules and everything, showed up at my house. We started playing it, and I realized he had no grasp of the game at all. We just couldn't proceed. After an hour or so, I think we ended up quitting. And I realized that the problem had been this, that there was this 30-year gap between us, me having grown up starting to play a game, particularly these war games, by reading the rules to such an extent that I didn't even really need to read the rules after a while. I knew that there was a certain case structure and things like this. Every game would be pretty much the same. We're just checking a few things to see if there were any significant differences, whether there was any chrome added. And then going ahead and playing the game. And for him, it was very difficult. Now, I also have two sons who I've occasionally done this with, one of whom played quite a bit of Dungeons & Dragons when he was young. For him, it's absolutely no problem to play a contemporary complex war game, complex role-playing game, whatever it is. He reads the rules, sucks it up like a sponge. My other son, however, doesn't have that background, can't do it at all. And it just made me real, these experiences of these diverse situations of, you know, my two sons and my former student trying to deal with a contemporary board game that involved reading rules told me that, wow, from this very unscientific sample, one out of three can even deal with reading the rule book. What is it, you know, before you even get to the point of playing the game? And I suspect what you're talking about, probably the odds are about the same. You know, there are some people who would say, oh yeah, okay, tutorial, great, I can deal with that. The majority, somewhere around two-thirds, three-quarters, 90%, are not going to want to do that. So what do you do? Well, Seeing Double was a really interesting exhibition. It's a little off to the side with your particular question, but it's kind of interesting to talk about. They basically took a lot of historical digital installed art projects set up a version, What is he waving at? Saying going back there. They set up each thing first on one side as close as they could to the original setup, with their engineers doing all kinds of work trying to make it seem like the original as much as possible. And then next to it, a reworked version or an emulated version or something like that. In one case, the original version didn't even work, but they still set it up, you know, not working at all. And again, they found out, they did surveys after people went through the exhibition, and people overwhelmingly preferred that new version. So I think the trick for you, and I hope no money is running on this, but I think the trick for you would be to think about an experience that does what the tutorial did, but does it in a reworked way, and might even in some way nod to or reference the tutorial as an experience, you know, that in some way would let people know that they're going through something that people went through with the historical game, you know, to make it fun in that way. But I, you know, everything I can see, every from exhibitions that I know of, suggests that the more, pretty much if you want to do something that everybody will be able to access, you're going to have to rework it. You know, there's just no doubt about that. But how to rework it?
And expect the game to tell them a whole lot of stuff, and it's going to say nothing, right? Because that's how we did the thing. You were expected to read the manual, and that was our standard reply to, you know, emails. Have you read the manual? Have you read the manual? If not, go and read it, then come back and ask an intelligent question.
Well, yeah, you know,
that's not a valid approach these days, right? We fully understand that. It's just, you know, we know what we've got to do these days, but in exactly on what you're talking about, recreating that experience, you can put it in front of people, and there are certain games that haven't changed, platform games, Jump, you know, Falling Lava, whatever. People get those all the time. Retro games exploit that, but they exploit it in carefully chosen subsets of our gaming genre, right, that are immediately available to everybody. Other games, not so.
Yeah, let me say something positive. About this, 2004, we did an exhibition at the Kanner Center on narrative games, and we chose a game from every decade up to that point. I think we did 84, 94, 2004, 74, 84, 84. Anyway, we had a text adventure in there, and we did observe some very positive experiences with multi-generational gameplay, where parents were talking to kids about what it was like to play a text adventure. You know, where you would have that conversation at the site of the installed game, and that was rewarding. But it depended on the fact that the 13-year-old went with her father or mother, to see this thing, and so that was that. You know, that kind of thing is very rewarding if maybe. That's the lemonade you could make out of those lemons, you know, kind of encourage some kind of conversation with people who had played a game a certain way many years ago to try to introduce that. That's kind of what I tried to do with my graduate student was, you know, hey, you know, you'll see what I did 30 years ago. It might not work all the time. It didn't work for me, but I have seen it work. So that might be another way to leverage that sort of thing. It is tough. It's a tough problem. And capturing that experience, you said, right? Yeah, absolutely. To have to see a conversation about that, I mean, to talk to you about, have somebody who has never played a game in that fashion sit down with you, have you go over it, talk about some of the differences, person says something about, oh, that seems like kind of a loony way to do this, and you talk about why, how things were different and so on. And just to record that conversation about it would be a valuable thing to do. Okay.
Would you please join with me in thanking Henry for a fabulous presentation?